accession number 28654, Mr. Leslie Gilbert, Reel 6. Now, we've got to where you were at Burka, for Burka 3.
Burka 3, yes.
Was there a Burka 2 and 1 then, that implies?
There was, yes. I don't really know the differences, except that while we were there, the Americans moved in and built a huge air base. Did I mention this previously? No, they built a huge air base a couple of miles away from us. I visited it once. I had to go over there for some technical reason or other, and I was just astounded, because there we were living in tents with really no mod cons at all, and the Americans had set up buildings and hot showers and goodness knows what. And they had Liberator bombers. And one day, and I suppose this must have been in the autumn of 1943, a whole number of these Liberators took off one after another, circled round until they were all up in the air, and they then flew off. We actually counted them out, and then in the evening they came back and we counted them back in again, a lot fewer. And I believe that was a major air raid on the Ploiești oil fields in Romania. I've looked on Google Earth to try to find the airstrips there, and there's just one, a great long white line in the middle of nothingness, and I think that must still be the American concrete runway. Our runway, you see, was just beaten earth.
Now, so you were there until all through 43, or through most of 43 then?
We were there until October 44. From February 43 was when we set off for Burka, and October 44 we were moved back.
Now, anything else happened while you were there, or was it basically just routine?
It was basically routine, yes, day after day doing this slogging work. It was almost like going to work in Civvy Street, in a sense, and nothing at all to do in the evening, so one tended just to get on with something connected with one's work. Actually, I made a radio from bits and pieces from one of our aircraft which had returned and crashed into a local hill, and we had to go and collect all the bits and pieces, and I scrounged some of them for myself and made quite a good shortwave radio. Even made a loudspeaker. It took me, goodness knows how long, weeks and weeks and weeks. I had, for example, winding a transformer 7,000 turns on the secondary, counting them. But then what else was there to do?
So you're just out there endlessly working on the radar?
Yes. Yeah.
So what happened in October 44?
In October 44, we were moved back to Alexandria. We had to dismantle all our bits and pieces, load up the trucks again, and drive back down the road, but this time not to Shalufa, but to Alexandria. We other ranks were not told at all what this was about. But after a short period in Alexandria, we were loaded up. This was in November 44, on a ship, and taken to Greece.
And do you know which ship it was?
No, it wasn't a big thing.
Where'd you go, Athens or...?
Yes, Piraeus.
That's the port?
That's the port for Athens, yes. Plato refers to it in his Republic, actually. Strolling back from Piraeus to Athens itself. Quite a long stroll. Well, when we got there, we were offloaded and driven through Athens to where we were going on open trucks, and the population were all out there in force, cheering and waving us, enormous reception. I hadn't realised at the time that the British didn't liberate Greece, the Greeks liberated Greece, and I'll come back to that in a moment. It's quite significant. The Greek resistance throughout the Germans. We were taken to a place called Glyfada, Glyfada, where we were billeted in great mansions. These were not ordinary houses, empty mansions, all in their own grounds. They must have belonged to very wealthy people, perhaps as kind of, I don't know, second homes from Athens. The Germans had obviously occupied them, and you might have thought that the Germans would destroy them when they left, instead of which they simply smashed up all the WC pans, something we could not understand. So there we were in these great mansions, using the gardens for our toilets. The mansions were, of course, quite empty, so we were sleeping on the floor, but at least we were in a building instead of under canvas.
Now, what about your air base?
The air base was at a place called Kalamaki, Kalamaki, which should have been, I don't know, half a dozen miles away, perhaps. Straight away, we noticed the state of the living conditions of the people. I mean, they had been starving, and they were still pretty well starving. Glyfada's right on the coast, and I remember seeing men rowing out in little boats into the sea, and then chucking into the water hand grenades. There are plenty of these hand grenades left lying around, and they'd explode underneath the surface, and tiny little fish would float up like white bait, and that would be food for them. I was told, I don't know that whether it's correct or not, that the doctor's wife of Glyfada there was one of the women in the local brothel in the evenings, in order to get money, obviously with her husband knowing about it, but I mean, they just had to live somehow. They were in a terrible state, and we heard awful stories about the behaviour of the Germans towards the Greeks. I still remember one story that a local told me of an incident in Athens itself, where a German lorry had been driving through, loaded up with bread for the troops, and it stopped at some traffic lights, and a little boy, little Greek boy, jumped up and grabbed one of the loaves and was simply shot dead. Also, on other occasions, apparently Greeks were shot dead pilfering used up truck tires. The tyres, I don't mean the inner tubes, which they made use of to resole their shoes. When we went out to go to the airbase, we were taken outside of our billets, lined up. There was by this time a bit of discipline, and we had rifles. It seemed very weird that the Germans had gone. We were issued with rifles and 5 rounds of ammunition each man. And this was undoubtedly a show of force against the Greek resistance. It was nothing at all to do with the German occupation. The Greek resistance had not yet laid down its arms. The government, which had taken over from the Germans, apparently had been pretty well imposed on the Greeks. It was not elected. And this accounted for a particular incident I remember on one occasion. On the airfield, we were detailed to load up our Wellingtons with leaflets, whole loads, piles of leaflets printed in Greek, which were obviously intended, well, we were told, to be dropped on Athens. and I asked the sergeant in charge what these leaflets said, because they were printed in Greek, of course. And he said they were instructions to the Greek resistance to hand in their arms. And I didn't think very much of this and said so. And he said, well, it's up to you. You can either load up the leaflets or refuse, in which case I'll put you on a charge. So I loaded up the leaflets and helped to grab Greece for the West, in a sense, I suppose. Of course, one knew very little about what was going on, really. We were cut off in many ways, but I did get the message, more or less.
What happened next, then? So you're there, you're still working on the radar? Or?
Oh, yes. Oh,
so that's a constant backdrop.
Yes, yes, still with Wellingtons. They'd been flown over, you see, from Benghazi. Then that in December 1944, another move with left the Piraeus and were put on a tank landing craft. I suppose there were several. I couldn't have been the whole squadron on one of them. Not designed for the open sea, really, and I was very, very sick. We called in, first of all, at some place whose name I don't know, in northwest Greece, and offloaded some Greek troops who obviously were not very popular with the local population. This is all to do, clearly, with the politics. Then we sailed off again to Italy and landed at Taranto.
So that was the end of your time in Greece, was it? Or
yes, it was a very short period.
So you'd gone before the revolution broke... revolution broke out in December, January. There was quite a lot of fighting in Athens. You'd left before that had
just really about started. Just about before, yes. Yes.
So now you've got... Whereabouts in Italy did you land?
We landed at Taranto and were moved just a little way inland to a place called, Grottaglie, Grottaglie. Now this was just before Christmas, 1944. We're living under canvas, and I didn't know that southern Italy could be so cold and so wet. It was really extremely unpleasant. A number of the tents fitted themselves up with homemade heating stoves burning aircraft fuel, 100 octane aircraft fuel. You had a naked flame in the tent, you see, burning. We didn't do it in our tent, fortunately, because a number of the tents got burnt down, and so all the stoves were confiscated and no petrol could be taken anymore. It was very poverty-stricken down there, I remember. And the toilets consisted of... there was an area with perhaps, 10 buckets, each bucket having a seat on it, arranged in a kind of square in the open air, with a canvas wall about 3 feet high put round. And one just squatted on these buckets in the open air in this little in this kind of enclosure with Italian women wandering past and making comments to us as they went, but taking it kind of for granted. And although I knew very little of what was going on, once again it was obvious that their conditions of life were very poor.
How did you get on with the Italians?
Well, you see, one had very little to do with people in circumstances like that. I really don't remember much about it at all. They were friendly, cheerful, you know. We tried talking to one another. No hostility at all. More or less the opposite. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say the opposite. I think they more or less took things for granted. You know, if it were not one lot, it was another lot. I don't think they knew why we were there, and I don't think we knew why we were there either in that place, because we just hung around for for a little while. Then
were they flying missions from Grottaglie?
I can't remember. But were there such a short time? We must have been, probably. What the missions were, I wouldn't be quite sure. I think by that time there was stuff going on in the Adriatic. And I suspect that the missions were more for the Adriatic than for the Mediterranean. In February 45, we were moved to Foggia, which is quite a big town in southern Italy. And there we were living in the town itself, in buildings. The airfield was a little way off. Now, this is when an event occurred that I found quite interesting. We had 24 Wellingtons. One day, they were all flown away and replaced by 24 brand new Wellingtons with a totally different type of radar, 9-centimeter radar.
Did it have a name, or was it just, was that what you called it, the 9-centimeter radar?
I think that's all it was called. I think it's still described as 9-centimeter radar. It was based upon the magnetron, the guts of the transmitter. The real thing was a magnetron, which was a British invention, I think invented during the 1930s, able to operate at a much higher frequency. You see, the ASV we had been on was 176 megahertz. This was, 9 centimetres, I think, is about 3.3 gigahertz. Higher frequency than satellite television is even now. And the magnetron was a very new device. It was so secret that inside the transmitter, alongside the magnetron, there was an explosive device, and the air crew were instructed that if they were in any danger, their first duty, before their own lives, was to destroy the magnetron. As I said, it was a British invention, but I've read up a bit about this, and when it was realised how important it was during the war, Churchill ordered that the design should be sent over to the United States so that it could be mass-produced there, because he was worried that bombing in the UK might disrupt the production of the device. I don't know, but I assume this meant that the British did not gain financially from the invention. Something I can never get over is this, that every microwave in the world now contains a magnetron.
What is a magnetron? I mean, can you explain it simply so that an idiot like me could understand?
I can try. Imagine a hollow cylinder, and in the middle is a filament that can emit electrons in all directions towards the wall of the cylinder. The wall of the cylinder being made positive in respect to with reference to the cathode, which emits the electrons, so the electrons would go outwards towards the edges of the cylinder. Now, applied across this cylinder was a very powerful magnetic force from a permanent magnet. Quite awkward, incidentally, because it was so powerful that you couldn't really use tools easily. Any screwdriver would just whiz out of your hand, and if you wore a watch, in those days, of course, they were not quartz watches, you'd ruin your watch. Anyway, the magnetrons, because of this magnetic field, were caused to spiral round instead of going straight across. And it's when electrons are... did I say magnetrons goes across? No, the electrons would be caused to spiral round, and that emitted the radiation, which was at 9 centimetres or 3.3 megahertz. It was a very robust device. I don't think we ever had one that went wrong. Everyone had a serial number, and as I said, they were dead secret. We had to account for them all. and in no time at all, our flight sergeant in charge of the unit managed to get one out of the books, as it were, sawed it in half, and then we all saw what the construction was. But I still find it extraordinary that this very, very secret and special device is now used as for microwave cookers. It's also, I believe, still used for radar. Now, there were no external aerials. In the nose of the aircraft, there was a dish, rather like a satellite dish that we have for satellite television these days, except that it was moving. It went round and round, and it also spiralled out and spiralled in again, so that it could look in different directions. The point being, it sent out a much, much narrower beam than the 176 megacycle did, so it had to move up and down and sideways in order to scan. I was put in charge of the workshop to service this stuff. None of us had been trained in it. I was given the manual, which was about almost as thick as a telephone book, and told to get on with it. And I just, stayed up at night and swatted up. And looking back now, I find it quite remarkable. I was, 24 years old at the time. 23 or 24, and there I was in charge of the servicing of the radar for 24 Wellingtons.
You did the lot.
I was in charge of the lot.
Yeah, no, but yeah. Your workshop did all 24.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we just had to learn how to do it.
Did they need much servicing?
I don't think they did, really. I can't remember. They're pretty reliable things. Most of the problems with the airborne radar were caused by the vibration in the aircraft, as much as anything else, because they did vibrate a great deal. But by this time, I think the problems would be more or less overcome. There was, by the way, also, apart from the magnetron, I seem to remember that the rectifier was a solid-state rectifier, and that was very, very early as well.
Now, what's a rectifier?
It's something that converts an alternating current into a direct current and has to be used when you're picking up any kind of radio waves in order to get a signal out of them. And it was just a little, it was a kind of crystal, I think. Not
was that new as well?
Yes. The whole thing was new. And I realise, of course, way, way in advance. For example, the radiation from the magnetron was conveyed to the receiver by a waveguide, not by any kind of cable. That's a kind of hollow tube, which carries the radiation along inside it.
And you were servicing the rectifiers as well, were you, or was it just the magnetron?
Oh, servicing the whole thing. Oh, no, the magnetron was part of the transmitter. The rectifier was part of the receiver. And then there was a very nice display unit based upon a cathode ray tube. And the display was quite unlike the display for ASV. I think I told you that for ASV you had a vertical trace and then sideways blips that would indicate a target. On this display, which was called a PPI, Plan Position Indicator, it's just like the kind of thing I'm sure you've seen on television yourself when people are looking at radar screens, where you just see a blob of light somewhere on the screen. There's no vertical trace at all. So you look on the screen, and if you see a blob towards your left, then the target's towards your left, or your right, towards your right. And if it's the distance away is indicated by how far the blob is from the centre of the screen. And of course you can have concentric indicating circles on the screen to indicate distances. It was the forerunner of the radar as we know it today, whereas the old ASV was just a very early crude thing. But the early crude stuff worked. You know,
but this worked better.
It was. I suppose it did in a way. It was more refined.
So you set up your workshop to service the new 9-centimeter wireless, radar.
Radar.
Anything else?
No, I don't think I can remember much there, because quite shortly afterwards, round about May 45, we were moved once again up to northeast Italy to a place near Ancona. Ancona is on the coast, and we were based at Falconara, F-A-L-C-O-N-A-R-A. There was an airfield there which we shared with the Americans. There was an American squadron of Mitchell bombers with Pratt and Whitney engines that must have been the most noisy things ever invented. Going past one of these things on the ground when it was running up its engines was something to be experienced.
They're still operational, because it's getting near VE Day.
Yes, we're still operational. I think they were, by that time, patrolling the Adriatic and having a go at the Germans, who were still further north somewhere. The work was not so intensive, though, and the whole spirit had gone out of the squadron.
Now, in what way? What do you mean? Surely it should have been getting better with the end of the war inside. What happened to the morale of the squadron?
Well, you see, when we were out in the desert, when we were out in Libya, it was very intensive operational work, and it was very meaningful work. It was extremely important. Don't forget, that was 1943. The war was by no means won. By the time we were up in at Falconara, it was clear that the war was virtually over. The Yalta Conference had taken place months beforehand, and one just had the feeling that everything was running down. And although life was easier, it was somehow less worthwhile. And by the way, I should have said that moving from Foggia up to Falconara, apparently the roads either side of Italy, running down either side of Italy, had been so badly affected, the bridges and so on, by the fighting, that they were almost impassable. And so we went up through along the spine of Italy, through the mountains, and this was in May, and it was extraordinarily lovely, real Italian spring. All the blossom was out. There were these hill villages with their black cypress, their dark cypress trees. It's something I'd like to revisit, actually. While we were at Falconara, I took a week's leave and went to Florence.
Now, is that after VE Day or before?
Oh, before VE Day. But after, of course, the Germans had retreated.
Now, what was your leave like in Florence?
Well, now, the Germans had treated it as an open city, so they'd not bombed it. But they had destroyed every bridge except the famous Ponte Vecchio. As well as that, there were virtually no road vehicles, and such vehicles as there were couldn't get any petrol. This meant that it was a pedestrian city, and you could just wander around. It was wonderful to be able to wander around in the middle of the road looking at these lovely buildings. I found it so attractive that after the war I persuaded my wife that we should go to Florence and have a week's holiday there, which we did in 1951. And it was traffic and mopeds, and it was quite awful, and I wished I'd never gone back. During the leave, I went in Florence. I went to the opera. I think I saw Bohème there, and I remember one of the singers did a beautiful aria, and when she'd finished, everybody started booing, and I thought, what on earth is going on? I discovered that they were actually shouting bis, meaning encore, bis, bis, and she sang it all over again. That was about the one of the few occasions in the whole of my service overseas when I experienced anything cultural. And when I came back to Britain and discovered that people had been going to cinemas and film theatres and ballet and so on, it came as a kind of shock, because I thought that life in Britain had been the way it was overseas. Now, I was at Falconara on VE Day.